From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's time again for the rush of holiday films, music, and books. On today's Fresh Air, John Powers reviews the new movies opening for the holidays. Kevin Whitehead reviews some jazz CD box sets you might want to consider for holiday gifts. And Maureen Carrigan gives her picks for the best books of the year. Also, we talk about Miles Davis with John Zwed, the author of a new biography called So What. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Today, for the first time, the Bush administration officially committed the United States to the deployment of a missile defense system. The first stage of the program is due to be operational by 2004. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
Since President Bush came into office, there have been several missile defense test failures. Program cost estimates have risen, and the demands of the war on terrorism have forced a reordering of some defense goals. But missile defense remains an administration priority. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says the United States is going ahead with a plan to deploy 20 so-called interceptor rockets on land and 20 at sea by 2005. These rockets should intercept and destroy ballistic missiles launched against the United States.
The initial capability would give us a limited capability to deal with a relatively small number of incoming ballistic missiles, which is better than nothing.
Pentagon officials say the administration will ask Congress for an additional $1.5 billion over and above $8 billion already budgeted for missile defense. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
Federal agents in Buffalo, New York, have arrested three Yemeni American men on charges that they illegally sent nearly $500,000 to Yemen. One of the men arrested was identified as Mohammed Albana, the uncle of one of the six men arrested earlier this year on charges of supporting a foreign terrorist organization. Albana has been a prominent advocate of the Yemeni community in Lackawanna and Buffalo, and he's proclaimed the innocence of the men who've come to be known as the Lackawanna Six. Albana denied any wrongdoing. Iraqi exiles have concluded a conference in London where they set up a committee they hope could replace Saddam Hussein's regime. The exile groups failed to bridge some major differences over how they see a future Iraq. Still, the Bush administration applauded the effort. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has reaction from Washington.
The Bush administration wanted to see the fractious Iraqi opposition come together in a show of unity. Though some delegates walked out in a dispute over the makeup of the committee, State Department spokesman Richard Boucher called the London conference a milestone.
This represents the broadest gathering ever convened of free Iraqis opposed to the tyrannical regime in Baghdad, and the participants should be commended for their efforts.
The State Department warned the Iraqis not to form a government in exile. Instead, after extra days of haggling, they set up a committee that could form the basis for a transitional government should Saddam Hussein be ousted. Boucher said he hopes the committee will consider policy recommendations from Iraqi exiles who have been meeting as part of the State Department's Future of Iraq project. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow lost 92 points today, about 1%, to close at 8,535 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 8 to close at 1392. This is NPR News. President Bush raised speculation today when he met with House Speaker Dennis Hastert. Reporters wanted to know why Senator Trent Lott wasn't invited and whether that meant that the White House no longer supports the incoming Senate Majority Leader. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said that observers shouldn't read too much into Lott's absence. The Mississippi senator is out of town, and Fleischer pointed out that the president often meets with Hastert alone. Lott's leadership has been in jeopardy since he made favorable remarks about Strom Thurmond's 1948 pro-segregation presidential campaign. At least 9 deaths, 6 in California, 2 in Oregon, and 1 in Nevada, have been blamed on the Pacific storms that brought record amounts of rain to the West Coast. NPR's Elaine Corey has more from San Francisco.
The Bay Area had a short break in the rough weather this morning as the latest storm moved into Nevada. Isolated thunderstorms are forecast for northern and central California by tonight, and up to 8 additional inches of snow are expected for the Sierra Mountains, which accumulated several feet over the weekend. Coastal flood warnings remain in effect for Southern California. The next major storm system is due to come ashore Thursday, packing 80-mile-an-hour winds. According to the National Weather Service, El Niño conditions have set the stage for stormier weather than usual across the entire southern United States this winter. Elaine Corey, NPR News, San Francisco.
Inflation remained almost unchanged in November. The Labor Department said its consumer price index rose only 0.1%, in part because lower prices for gas and clothing offset a boost in the costs of food and health care. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from White Wave, the makers of Silk, a lactose-free organic soy milk available in the refrigerated section of supermarkets and natural food stores. Silk is soy.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of movies are opening for the holidays. We've asked our film critic, John Powers, to talk with us about them. John is also media columnist and film critic for LA Weekly. John, one of the movies opening for the holidays is Martin Scorsese's new film, Gangs of New York. It's taken a very long time for this movie to actually hit the theaters. What's the problem been?
Well, it's actually one of those strange films that comes with an accumulated weight of baggage that makes everybody wonder how good the film is going to be. They finished shooting it maybe 18 months ago, and there was lots of talk that it was going to come out last Christmas. But in fact, they didn't finish editing the final version until time for this Christmas. And there was a lot of thought that maybe Martin Scorsese, the director, was fighting with Harvey Weinstein from Miramax. And there's some dispute, I guess, over the final length of the film and what exactly should be in it. And so this is a film that comes to us with so much gossip surrounding it that when you go to see the film, you actually have to sort of cut through that to see what the film actually is.
And what is the film actually? Did you like it?
I don't really like the film. I don't think it's a very good film, although it's an incredibly grand film. It's an attempt, I think, to make a film about 19th century New York that has the scope and scale of the first two Godfather films or Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America. It's a great immigrant saga, and it has to do essentially with immigrant New York and the battles between the people who already lived there, who resent the newcomers, and the immigrants trying to make their life. Set against the backdrop of the Civil War era, when immigrants would get off the boat, be given citizenship, and immediately shipped off to go fight in the Civil War as cannon fodder. So, and what Scorsese gives you is that time and place in the midst of one of the most elaborate sets I've ever seen. So there's a huge set that was built in Cinecittà Studios in Rome, which gives you a 19th century New York City. And then in the midst of the film, there's a plot about a bad nativist, as they're called, which are people who basically don't like the immigrants, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, and his blood feud with the son of a murdered Irish immigrant, and that's played by Leonardo DiCaprio.
How are DiCaprio and Daniel Day-Lewis?
Yes. One is extremely good and one isn't. DiCaprio, when he was younger, seemed to have a lot of kind of primal force as an actor. But as he grew older, he's gotten slightly wispy. And this is sort of a two-fisted epic where people are actually going after one another with cudgels. And really, there's nothing about Leonardo DiCaprio that makes him seem like a good cudgel wielder. In contrast, Daniel Day-Lewis is an actor of just enormous vitality and energy. And he's giving a really wonderful, theatrical, broad, strangely sympathetic performance as this guy who, if you can imagine this, is some sort of 19th century cross between, say, Travis Bickle from Taxi Driver and Pat Buchanan. So he's actually simultaneously wrought up, crazed, honorable, really funny. And he dominates the film so much that it's almost a problem for the film because there's no real counterweight to him in the movie.
So would you recommend the film?
I would recommend the film. Having said all the bad things, what's really remarkable in the film is that it gives you a feeling for an aspect of American history that probably none of us ever really learned in school. Because, I mean, the tagline for the film, which is something like "America was born in the streets," is very, very accurate. Because what this film shows you is how most of what we think of as modern America, be it modern American freedoms, modern American cities, modern American values, were actually created by people from outside the country coming in and fighting in the streets for rights and ideas. And I don't think I can think of very few films that actually show this more compellingly than this. So that, in fact, although parts of the film bored me, the last half hour builds to this great, magnificent, and deeply ironic and sort of dark, it must be said, vision of the city of New York that is extraordinarily powerful. So although I was unhappy earlier in the film, except when Daniel Day-Lewis was on, and I was always happy when he was on, by the end I actually thought, this actually is a strong movie, although it's probably a failed movie.
Fresh Air film critic John Powers is my guest. We're talking about movies that you can see over the holidays. Now, Leonardo DiCaprio is in two movies opening for the holidays. There's Gangs of New York, which you were just talking about, and also Catch Me If You Can, which is based on a true story and directed by Steven Spielberg. What's the story the movie's based on?
Yeah, well, it's actually based on the slightly fishy-seeming but very compelling autobiography.
Yeah.
Of a guy by the name of Frank Abagnale, who was a very successful young con man who left home at the age of 16 and by the age of 20 had already passed himself off as a Pan Am pilot, as the head of an ER in an Atlanta hospital, and as an assistant district attorney. And in addition to that, had kited $4 million worth of checks. Okay, that's the basic story. And Leonardo DiCaprio plays this kid who, rather like Spielberg himself, he was sort of a prodigy, and entered the world and sort of took the adult world by storm because he was just so good at faking it. And so it's a charming romp of a film. I had actually kind of dreaded it. I think the trailers for the film make it look slightly unbearable. But when I actually saw the film, I and almost everyone in the room, you know, was extraordinarily happy. You know, if Scorsese's film Gangs of New York came in with this huge weight of expectation and then was probably disappointing, Catch Me If You Can came in with people thinking, good Lord, doesn't Steven Spielberg ever stop making movies? You know, he'd made AI just last summer, then he made Minority Report this summer, and now he's got this one. And probably this is my favorite of the three of them. It's fast and funny. Leonardo DiCaprio is very, very good. He's a very good light actor now and is very, very charming. And in the film, he's being chased by an FBI agent played by Tom Hanks, who's really wonderful and sly in this movie. In fact, he's all the good things that people like about Tom Hanks in this movie, rather than the kind of overbearing things that you saw in Road to Perdition earlier this year.
Well, there's two movies about double lives opening for the holidays. One is Catch Me If You Can, and the other is the movie about Chuck Barris called Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. Some of our listeners might not remember Chuck Barris, who was the king of game shows. Do you want to talk about who Chuck Barris was first?
Chuck Barris was one of these people who many people have never heard of, but was one of the defining figures in the way American culture went starting in the 1960s. He invented two famous game shows, one the dating game and one the newlywed game. And in addition to that, he invented a show called the Gong Show, where essentially talentless people were brought on stage to reveal the fact that they had no talent and then basically get the hook. Anyway, so Chuck Barris is this strange marginal figure on the one hand. I mean, he's not really a star. He's not really a celebrity. He's not the kind of person that you would normally get a biopic of. But he was this weird showbiz figure who then wrote a very strange autobiography in which he claimed that when he was essentially not running things like the dating game, he was actually a CIA assassin. He had a second life. And That is essentially the Chuck Barris story that's in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, which has been directed by George Clooney, following a script by Charlie Kaufman, who is having a big year. I mean, Charlie Kaufman is this guy who people might remember who wrote Being John Malkovich. And for years, he was considered someone who was so marginal and so wigged out that he would never get anything made. This year, he has three films. And in fact, two of them are coming out in the same three-week period. One is the new film Adaptation, which is just coming out. And after this is Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, which traces in bizarre fashion Chuck Barris's rise as a TV executive and hitman.
Do you buy the story? Do you think it's true?
I don't buy the story, and it's clear the filmmakers don't buy the story. They play it, oddly enough, as sort of a stylized, sort of sub-Brechtian tale in which everything is made so deliberately heightened and stylized that you don't really believe what you're seeing. I mean, the most realistic things in the film are the scenes from the dating game, whereas all the CIA stuff is done with pull-away sets and elaborate camera moves that clearly accentuate the fact that George Clooney and the writer Charlie Kaufman don't believe that he actually was a hitman. In fact, they stylize it so much, you don't even believe that Chuck Barris really believed he was a hitman, which may be one of the problems with the film. As you're watching, you're shifting between different layers of reality, but you never really feel yourself connecting to the character because it's so out there. I would just say parenthetically that one of the interesting things about the screenwriter, Charlie Kaufman, is that when he makes a movie like Adaptation, he needs a director who plays it straight. Because Kaufman's scripts are so nuts that if the director tries to ratchet it up, it's a huge mistake because then everything just flies off into the ether. And I think that's essentially what happens with Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. In contrast, Spike Jonze, who directed Adaptation, keeps everything anchored so that Meryl Streep and Chris Cooper are very convincing playing a New Yorker writer and her subject.
This is the Confessions of a Dangerous Mind is George Clooney's debut as a director. Tell us more about what you think of him as a director based on this first entry.
Yes, well, he's actually an interesting director because I think he directed the film incorrectly, which is to say that I think he heightens things too much so that the film doesn't actually work. But he breaks out of the mold of actors turned directors. Usually when actors, especially stars, start directing films, they go for very simple actor-driven stories with very simple camera setups. You know, and they essentially count on knowing what it is they know, which is acting. What Clooney has done is to do some sort of huge exercise in style so that the film in some ways that it reminds me of most is another movie that's coming out at Christmas, which is the adaptation of the musical Chicago, which is also a sort of vaguely Brechtian enterprise where everything is kept deliberately unreal and artificial. And what Clooney has done is, for his first job, done something that's a far harder piece of direction than, say, his friend Steven Soderbergh did in a lot of his work, than almost any film this year.
So you're saying that that there's something about the direction of Confessions of a Dangerous Mind that reminds you of Chicago. Chicago is another one of the movies opening for the holidays. It's adapted from a Candor and Ebb Broadway musical. What is it successful in becoming a movie?
Yes, it actually is successful in becoming a movie. You know, I think that the Hollywood musical is probably the holy grail of film genres. It's remarkable if you look back at it how almost anybody who has any talent or power as a director in Hollywood has tried at one point to make a musical. And it's widely thought that it's impossible to do it anymore. I wouldn't be surprised if Chicago proved to be the most successful one in years and years and years. What they've done is they've taken the very successful musical and found a way to adapt it whereby the characters don't just break into song as they often do in musicals. That kind of artificiality seems not to play with audiences anymore in movie theaters. So what the director Rob Marshall came up with was a concept where there are basically two levels of reality going on. There's the level of reality of the play, and then there's of the story, excuse me, and then the level of reality of performances going on at a music hall. And those two bleed into one another so that a person might start off in a sequence singing, and then it will actually merge into something that's happening in real life or vice versa. But that separation seems to work for the audience because it doesn't mean that people are just sitting in their living room suddenly breaking into songs, which, as I say, people don't seem to buy anymore in movies.
Well, how are Catherine Zeta-Jones and Renee Zellweger as singers? I don't think we've seen them sing before or heard them sing.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, one of the things that happens when you make a musical nowadays is that one is always struck by the fact that the people they cast are surprisingly good. And I think I would say that of Renee Zellweger and Catherine Zeta-Jones, is that one doesn't think of them as being able to sing and dance. So that when they come out and do sing pretty well and dance pretty well, it seems even more impressive than probably it would if they were just doing what they regularly did, or if you brought out people who were known for singing and dancing. I mean, it's a strange time in show business because, you know, there was an era when the Hollywood studios had people who could be counted on to do every single kind of thing you needed to do in a musical. So that you actually would just have performers who everyone knew could sing wonderfully and dance wonderfully and often both. Now you actually are always cobbling together films with the stars who were able to do certain things. You know, so the Catherine Zeta-Jones, you know, is very, very good in the film. I was quite surprised at how well she did it. I've been told she was once a Corrine, and perhaps that's true, but she actually moves pretty well. But you know, the film's editing style, you know, as often happens with musicals these days, is quite fast. You know, it's not as fast as, say, so-called MTV cutting. But what you don't have is that Renee Zellweger or Catherine Zeta-Jones have to actually hold the screen with no cuts for a minute dancing. You know, in the old days, you know, if you were directing, say, Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly, you could actually just put the camera there and they could do the number perfectly and you'd never need to do anything. With today's stars, they just aren't that good. Plus, people are used to a faster editing rhythm, so that, you know, what will happen is you'll see Catherine Zeta-Jones or Renee Zellweger moving for maybe 15 seconds. Then there'll be a cut. So if they've made any mistakes in the dancing or the singing, that can be replaced.
My guest is Fresh Air film critic John Powers. We'll talk more about holiday movies after a break. This is Fresh Air. Film critic John Powers is my guest, and we're talking about some of the movies opening for the holidays. Now, the second in the trilogy of Lord of the Ring movies is opening for the holidays. You, as I recall, were surprised to find that you liked the first Lord of the Rings. What do you think of the second one?
Well, the second one isn't as good as the first. I was talking to a friend afterward who loves the Lord of the Rings and loves these films, and even she was saying, this is a second act, which is to say that the problem you have is that the first part gets to set up the world, and the last part has all the dramatic payoff. Here in the middle, you basically are just sort of making the story get from the beginning to the end.
Sounds like junior high school.
It is like junior high school. It's kind of unsatisfying. There are spectacular things in it. There's, you know, perhaps a little overlong, but a genuinely spectacular siege sequence that is the kind of thing that movies have tried to do for years and years and haven't. When you think of all the George Lucas movies and the new Star Wars movies that are failing so badly, the new movie, The Two Towers, actually does a lot of that epic stuff with people fighting and battling and having big passions incredibly well. And there is a really wonderful part live, part digitally created creature named Gollum, who's the sort of tragic villain of the Lord of the Rings series. And when he's on screen in The Two Towers, the movie really comes to life. I mean, the tricky thing with the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy is it's basically two kinds of things going on at once. There's the really good thing, which is the story of the ring and the hobbit who has to destroy the ring while the ring is so powerful that it weakens him and corrupts him, and he has to battle to preserve his integrity while doing the right thing, which I think is the human story. Then there's the story, which I've never found very interesting, which is the struggle for the imaginary Middle Earth, which is filled with gnomes and dwarves and trolls and hobbits and thousands of people involved in battle sequences. I suspect if you're a Lord of the Rings fanatic, you actually want to see those battle sequences. And the director, Peter Jackson, gives them to you in spectacular fashion. But if you're more interested in the moral side of the story, part two is probably going to be the least successful of the three.
Well, you just voted in the Los Angeles Film Critics Association Awards. And maybe you could just like run through and compare your votes with how the association voted for like the top awards.
Well, it was actually kind of fun this year because I think I had never actually had my top choice win anything ever. I think that may even be true in my political life as well. Is that, you know, I just always think when I go to vote, I always lose. This year, I had voted for actually my favorite film, and I don't think you like this one perhaps, but the film I enjoyed watching most this year was Y Tu Mamá También.
Which oh, I correct for me. For. I really didn't like it.
Yes, so I probably would have voted for it for my favorite film, but About Schmidt was the film that won, and I happily voted for it. For Best Actor, it came down to two people. It actually was a tie in Los Angeles between Daniel Day-Lewis and Jack Nicholson, who's the star of About Schmidt. Daniel Day-Lewis is in Gangs of New York, And I was completely content. These are two movies that essentially rise or fall on the performance of these guys. And they're both really, really good. For Best Actress, it was Julianne Moore for Far From Heaven. And I think she won because she's good in the film, undeniably. But also because not only has she been good in this film, she's been good for a long, long time. And I think this is one of those happy occasions, and I think she'll probably win the Oscar for the same reason, where people realize, oh, this is the dream role for a person who we've actually liked for years and years and years, and who's always honorable and good, and now it's their time. And I think that's what's going to happen with Julianne Moore. I voted for her as well. With some of the other things, Best Foreign Film, we gave it to Y Tu Mamá También over the Almodóvar film Talk to Her. But that's because Almodóvar had won Best Director for Talk to Her. And so critics groups, you know, tend not to be really rigid about voting their conscience in every case. It often happens that if you think Pedro Almodóvar has won one thing, you'll vote for somebody else to spread the wealth around. And I think that's what happened here.
John, you took a hiatus from film reviews. You write a media column for Los Angeles Weekly. And after a while of not writing reviews, you've returned to reviewing again. Did you miss the compulsory aspect of movie going during that hiatus from reviewing?
Yes. I think the thing that I learned is that I was much more forgiving of movies when I was paying than when I was able to go for free, which I think is a very odd thing. That there was about 2.5 years where I really was only going to things that I wanted to go to, and I wasn't on press screening lists, and would simply show up with my $8, you know, and I was actually more willing to forgive things under those circumstances than when I was on the treadmill of seeing 400 or 500 films a year. And, you know, you would think it would be the other way, but, you know, you're putting good money into this theater. How could you not be, you know, have more expectations? But it just doesn't work that way. In the same kind of way, I think that many people would have had the experience that when you turn on something on, say, HBO or Showtime or Cinemax, something that you might have actually been enraged by in the theater, you're prepared to sit through and think, oh, this isn't so bad. You know, why were the critics so harsh on that? And you realize it's the context determines so much. So now that I'm back, I'm trying to keep some of that that freshness that I had when I was just going as a paying customer to what I'm doing, which probably, you know, I probably will soon be warped and jaded again. But at the moment, I'm not.
Well, John, I wish you happy holidays.
Yes, and happy holidays to you, Terry.
John Powers is film critic and media columnist for LA Weekly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, committed to serving Lutherans, their families, and communities with financial strategies and customer-focused service, online at thrivent.com. And Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of A Singular Hostage, a novel set in 19th century India by Thalassa Ali. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, book critic Maureen Carrigan gives her picks for the best books of the year. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews some box sets that could make good holiday gifts. And we talk with John Zwett about his new biography of Miles Davis called So What? This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has drawn up her best books list for 2002, plus a couple of last-minute mentions of very good books that she's just caught up with.
This was the year of interesting to superb first novels. Out of that group of debutantes, the one that's my pick for the best novel of 2002 was the one I most didn't want to read, The Lovely Bones by Alice Sebold. This is a story narrated from heaven by an adolescent girl named Susie Salmon, who's been raped and murdered by a serial killer, an act we readers witness in the opening of the novel. The torture and death of a child probably tops the list of subjects I don't want to know about, but because I was required to keep reading, I ended up having a singular, disturbing, and even enlightening literary experience. The predictable backlash has begun against The Lovely Bones. Some critics are now accusing the book of being sentimental. Ignore them. I can still hear Susie's remarkable voice, questioning, wry, hollow, and so powerful it sometimes overwhelms all the reassuring noises of everyday life. Another terrific debut novel this year was The Dive from Clawson's Pier by Ann Packer. Packer has a gift for deceptively unadorned language that captures the complexities of romantic love and its burdens. Her heroine, a young Midwesterner named Carrie Bell, is about to break her engagement when her fiancé breaks his neck and becomes a quadriplegic. Sounds melodramatic, I know, but the psychological subtlety of Packer's language, the way she hints at rather than overstates Carrie's decisions, really distinguishes this novel. Atonement by Ian McEwan is the best novel of the year by a literary old master. It's a brilliant, nuanced, and technically sly tale that spans the 1930s to the present and leaves readers with the unsettling conviction that only the strong and unscrupulous survive. The nonfiction standouts this year are an appealingly motley bunch. Bad Blood by the late British literary critic Lorna Sage is a vivid, tragicomic memoir by a daughter of the 1950s who got knocked up but not knocked down. In The Devil's Snare by renowned women's historian Mary Beth Norton suggests a new and very convincing solution to the enduring mystery of the Salem witch hunts. Another scholar, Mark Edmondson, sidesteps mawkishness in his shrewd, class-conscious memoir, Teacher, about an eccentric high school teacher who transformed Edmondson from a football thug to an avid reader, and also introduced him to the hard reality that thinking hurts. The Good Women of China, by Chinese radio journalist Xin Ran, recounts the difficult lives of contemporary female factory workers, entrepreneurs, peasants, and intellectuals in that country. Xin Ran says the question that obsessed her all the while she was doing her radio show in China during the 1990s was, just what is a woman's life worth in China? You get the feeling throughout this book that she's still reeling from the answer. A couple of books I've just caught up with deserve a mention before the year is out. Don't Tell Mama is the title of the Penguin Book of Italian-American Writing, edited by feminist literary scholar Regina Barreca. As that cheeky title suggests, this is a boisterous and frequently moving collection of autobiographical essays, poems, and fiction excerpts designed to dispel the prejudice that, apart from Don DeLillo, Gay Talese, and Mario Puzo, Italian Americans make better cooks, gangsters, and filmmakers than they do writers. And I've just read the big buzz book of early fall, I Don't Know How She Does It, by Allison Pearson. This is the comic novel about a working mother of two named Kate Reddy, who manages hedge funds in London by day and cleans up spilt apple juice and vomit at home by night. The so-called fairy tale ending, where Kate quits her high-powered job, makes me a bit uneasy. But I laughed helplessly out loud throughout most of this novel, starting with the very first page that finds Kate, late at night in her kitchen, busily distressing a store-bought mince pie for a party at her daughter's preschool so that the stay-at-home moms, or Muffia as she calls them, won't sneer at her. I don't know how she does it, is hip to the complications of class and generational differences, and above all, to the catch-22 situations of women caught in an unfinished feminist revolution. And it's filled with such droll one-liners, like when Kate describes her unshaven husband as looking like Ted Hughes left in the tumble dryer. As of the end of 2002, the Brits are still tops when it comes to literary wit. But there's always hope for the colonies in 2003.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Her complete list can be found on our website, freshair.com. Coming up, we talk with John Zwed about his new biography of Miles Davis. This is Fresh Air. My guest, John Zwed, is the author of a new biography of Miles Davis called So What, named after the Miles composition. In the introduction, Zwed acknowledges that several biographies of the great jazz trumpet player have already been written. Zwed says he has tried to write a meditation on Miles Davis's life. It's been 11 years since Miles died, and as Zwed points out, he still seems omnipresent. We refer to him by his first name in acknowledgement of his pervasive influence. At jazz festivals, Miles Davis tributes outdraw newer musicians' performances. Trumpeters still copy his playing. John Zwed is also the author of the books Jazz 101 and Space is the Place, a biography of the jazz composer and musician Sun Ra. And he's a professor of African American Studies, Music, and American Studies at Yale. Let's start with music. This is Miles Davis's 1954 recording of the Rodgers and Hart song, It Never Entered My Mind. John Zwed, welcome to Fresh Air. Miles, during this period, gravitated towards songs and show tunes. Can you talk a little bit about why he loved to play those songs?
Yeah, he particularly was fond of, early on, some singers who are not so well known anymore. But Blossom Dearie comes to mind, and Jerry Southern, and Shirley Horn, who's still very much with us, and Helen Merrill later on. And these are singers that basically are slow burners, sort of low vibrato chanteuses who worked a certain kind of song so slowly, as Shirley Horn said, no one could tell where the one was, where the downbeat was when they sang. And in a sense, they keep the romantic quality of the songs, but they move them to a new place. And what's outrageous, I guess, in the time when Miles was doing this stuff first, which was, what, the early 50s, is that this is a period after bebop had effaced those tunes, had sort of hidden them with these melodies, what should I say, signified on these melodies and made them something else. And here comes Miles, and then later Chet Baker, turning this corner of saying, hey, we can play these tunes straight.
At some point when Miles started to move away from songs, you quote him as saying he didn't want to be restricted by the breath limits of singers and the restrictions of word phrases. Do you think that when he moved away from songs, he started playing the kind of music that wouldn't work as song, that singers couldn't sing, that wasn't adapted at all for the voice?
Yeah, and in that he was not alone. And that, in talking mid-60s again, you could have heard this first a little earlier in Ornette Coleman, some of the so-called free jazz players, who were also escaping those sort of two- and four-bar phrases that in which singers sang, in which the lyricists wrote for. And oddly enough, or maybe appropriately enough, this is a period also where poets began to think in larger breath units, which is to say, go out to the end of the line and see how far you can go, or even write, in the case of Ginsberg, write out to the end of the page and then stop and start over again.
What do you consider to be the first important record in his move away from song?
Well, as an entire album, Kind of Blue, which is still his mega best-selling kind of piece of music, because they began to think in terms of, instead of the usual pop song forms, in terms of modes and other approaches to it. So there were, it was a kind of elasticity built into it. They could play for a short time, they could play for a long time.
You want to choose a piece from Kind of Blue?
Yeah, one of Flamenco Sketches.
Okay, here it is. That's from the Miles Davis album Kind of Blue, recorded in 1959. My guest, John Zwett, is the author of the new book, So What? The Life of Miles Davis. A lot of Miles Davis's early music had a very beautiful, romantic sound to it. You've spoken to some of the women who were either married to Miles Davis or spent some time as lovers with him. Was he a romantic lover in the way you might expect him to be listening to those beautiful records?
I think there was that element there. Clearly, the music communicated a certain kind of character, and many people said to me that when they found that he was that his character was not quite in line with those songs, that, to put it mildly, that they were surprised. They thought he was what he played. In fact, a sort of Miles school trumpet player, Art Farmer, said Miles played the way he wanted to be. And this is a bad aesthetic and bad emotional mistake to treat things that way. And they always thought, at least some of them thought, that that must be his core self somewhere, and all he needed to do was to be with the right woman to have it surface. This turns out not to have been such an easy course for many people, because particularly under the influence of cocaine, which produced severe paranoia in Davis for years, that he could be very violent and extremely difficult, not just with women, but with men. But it does suggest that it went very deep into the way he related to people.
What's an example of how his paranoia was expressed through his actions?
He was delusional, I think, at worst points. As he himself said, he thought an elevator was his car, and then people got inside, he wondered what they were doing in his car. He thought people were, this was very common when he thought people were under rugs, under furniture, and before he'd feel safe, he'd have to go check these things out. He mistook snow on the ground for being cocaine. He stepped through windows and doors. It was severe delusion, and he spells a good deal of this out in his own autobiography. Despite those kind of problems of use, he nonetheless took care of business, as they would say. He showed up at recording sessions early. He was organized, in spite of the kind of strange organization that he used, which was very often, I'm going to make all the space in the world for you, and you better come through. His sense of knowing how to arrange people is no small skill. I say arrange people because that's what he was doing rather than music. He knew how to bring the best out of himself and other people. So it's really quite extraordinary to see this balancing act going on where he can barely stand up at some points, and yet he can produce this incredible music.
Talk a little bit more about what you mean by he didn't arrange music, he arranged people.
Well, this doesn't happen very often in the arts, I think. You know, we talk about improvisation That's usually an individual kind of thing, and there's some talk in the theater about it, but there's always a kind of structure to this that's more there than we're led to believe sometimes. But a few times, musicians have attempted to bring people into a studio and see what would happen. Apparently, according to Eric Clapton, Bob Dylan did this on one case, filling a studio with 20-some people, and nothing happened. In fact, they just irritated each other, and Dylan kept running out for more people. But Miles did the same kind of thing. In any number of sessions, starting in the late 60s particularly, he would bring people in who didn't even know that other people would be there, so they would sometimes have three or four keyboardists turn up and three drummers, all staring at each other and wondering, where do I sit, what do I do, and so forth. And when asked, what do I do, as one drummer asked one time when he was staring at the other two, he said, we'll let Jack DeJohnette lead the drum section because he's the one wearing the sunglasses, that kind of thing. Or when asked, what do we play on this tune, as John McLaughlin, the guitarist, asked one time, he said, play like you've never played guitar before. Play like you don't know how to play. The famous remark to Herbie Hancock, sit on your left hand, and then at one point, sit on your right, too. When asked, what should I play? If you don't know, don't play anything. This ability to bring people in like that, and then when he did have music, something like Joe Zawinul's In a Silent Way, he erased the chords, so he took the basic structure of the piece out, opening up the possibility for all sorts of things to happen. I think this may not be so striking to other people, but to me at least, the degree of seriousness of the man about what he was doing was stunning. His approach to this music was that of an intellectual and a purist, although it's very hard to make that case to many people who don't know this music that well. It's hard to find an artist more devoted to what he's doing than what Davis brought to this. It's often chaotic, it's often destructive in a variety of ways, but this is a man who wants to do something perfectly, and he wants to get it to sound like nothing's ever been heard before. And that's the reason they continued to change music. He was, I thought, rather modestly said once at the White House when someone said, what did you do to get invited here? He said, I think it was the elder Bush's White House, he said, I changed music four or five times. What did you do other than sleep with a white man? I believe the line went. I count that he's changed the music six or seven times, maybe eight if you want to be a part of that.
Well, John Zwed, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Zwed is the author of the new book, So What? The Life and Times of Miles Davis. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews CD box sets you might consider for holiday gifts. This is Fresh Air. A lot of jazz CD box sets and compilations are released toward the end of the year, timed for the gift-giving season. If you're shopping for a jazz fan, critic Kevin Whitehead has a few high- and low-budget suggestions and one must to avoid. Thank you.
Chuck Mangione? Herb Alpert? No. Miles Davis and jazz's answer to Elvis's fat period. In the 1980s, even when the trumpeter's lip didn't sound like raw hamburger, Miles was done in by his glitzy funk bands with their vulgar string synthesizers, chime racks, and sampled voices. That's from this season's most overstuffed jazz box. 20 CDs of Miles Davis recorded at the Montreux Festival, almost all of it from the dismal 1980s. It feels strange touting holiday box sets in a tanked-out economy, so let me save you big bucks by waving you off this mess. Only Miles haters or happy jazz freaks could love it. With all the money you've saved not buying that, you can now think about giving some of this season's smaller and better compilations. The big jazz story this year was the glorious return of one ex-Miles Davis saxophonist, and the 2-CD anthology The Classic Blue Note Recordings of Wayne Shorter focuses on his 1960s peak. Shorter recorded half of it under his own name, and most of the rest with drummer Art Blakey. There's a lot of great tenor saxophone playing, and Wayne Shorter's cunning and catchy tunes remain much imitated and unmatched. The only hitches are a couple of slices of his bad 1980s music. From 1964, here's Witch Hunt with Elvin Jones on drums. If you want to be very nice to a fan of early jazz, for me, this year's standout box is the classic Columbia and OK Joe Venuti and Eddie Lang sessions from the mail-order house Mosaic. It's 8 CDs of stuff recorded between 1927 and 1935, and it's a gold mine, a reminder what big boxes are good for. It gives you a sweeping perspective on jazz and American pop during a formative period. That's Joe Venuti on violin. But this box belongs to Philadelphia-born guitarist Salvatore Massaro, usually known as Eddie Lang and sometimes as Blind Willie Dunn. Back when the music business was routinely segregated, Lang often crossed the color line to record blues with Bessie Smith or Lonnie Johnson, as well as pop and jazz with Bing Crosby or Bix Beiderbecke. They all turn up in this box. The way Lang worked Italian string inflections into the blues taught scores of non-African Americans how to fold their roots into jazz. Here's Lang with King Oliver on trumpet, 1928. Of material Eddie Lang recorded before his death in 1933 reminds us how fluid the boundaries were between musical styles back then. His work would influence hillbilly and country and even rock music at least as much as jazz. Lang's recorded Odyssey is an epic tale told in 3-minute installments, and the Venuti Lang box is a high-yield investment. Jimmy Dorsey on baritone sax. Since the jazz vocal is in resurgence, you might attempt to turn fans of younger singers onto some old masters the new vocalists study. One worthy item in a recent batch of 1940s reissues on Savoy is a double set by bedroom baritone Billy Eckstein, back when he stocked his band with young hipsters like Dizzy Gillespie, Art Blakey, and Miles Davis. On the legendary Big Band, Eckstein's rippling vibrato sounds a little dated, but his sexy man voice set the style for lots of later singers, and he showed welcome restraint on the blues. Here's Eckstein with Gene Ammons on tenor sax.
It's a downright rotten, low down, dirty shame. It's a downright rotten, low down, dirty shame. The way you're treating poor me, I know I'm not to blame.
Billy Eckstein's protege, Sarah Vaughan, appears on one track here, and he turns up once on the definitive Sarah Vaughan. It's one in a new series of single-disc anthologies drawing on several labels. Some of these so-called definitive collections aren't really that, but a few are first-rate, like one devoted to trumpeter Clifford Brown. The Sarah Vaughan shows off her luminous tone and superb ear as she's backed by spry jazz combos or string orchestras that don't quite sync the show. Even Mom will like it, and you'll get out of the store spending less than $15. Box sets are nice, but a bargain is beautiful.
I've heard it said that the thrill of romance can be like a heavenly dream. I go to bed with a prayer that you'll make love to me. Strange as it seems.
So Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. For the list of his Christmas picks, check the Fresh Air website at freshair.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Boldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Ooh, what we've been missing, love a man.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Find Law, offering an online directory of more than 1 million attorneys, plus consumer and business legal guides, providing a place to find answers. Find lawyers, find law. FINDLAW.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, total information awareness and other post-9/11 security measures. We talk with lawyer David Cole, who thinks these measures risk violating the civil liberties of Americans, and lawyer Douglas Kmeck, who supports these measures. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.